session number 22631, Reel 1.
Elaine Cheverton on the 9th of February at Elaine's home.
So I'll just check that we're... I think so, where and when were you born? Would you like to...
Yes, yeah. Have we started?
Yes, we started.
Right, okay.
I was making sure the levels were right.
Yeah. My father was in the Indian Army, and I was born in 1920... my mother actually came home to have me, but I went out again when I was 6 weeks old. And there was a lot of frontier fighting with the Waziris and Afghans going on at the time, so my father was away a lot. And I came home for schooling when I was seven, as most people did, because there weren't educational facilities there. And I went to boarding school, and then I went out again. I was 19 when war broke out, and went out. Then my parents were over on long leave, and I went back with them. And I got a job first of all was in Secunderabad, and got a job with a local army headquarters. I'd done secretarial thing. Then my father was posted to Quetta. And I was in Quetta when I was recruited by somebody who had been in the WASBs. I don't think it was Gay Tucker, but somebody was a friend of Gay Tucker's. And she came to Quetta, and she was sort of recruiting. And Phyllis Jeffries and I joined up from there. It was a three-day journey from Quetta across to Shillong. And that was in 1942.
Yeah. Why did you join?
Oh, why did I join?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't very happy in the sort of rather rigid social life that went on, even though the war was on. When I first got out, they didn't even call it the war. They said it was a sort of present state of emergency or something like that. And people's whiskey ration was reduced from, and so on. And also it sounded something very interesting and different. And, it was a marvellous experience, really, despite the discomforts and the bad bits. It was a really marvellous experience. So I had a short time in Shillong when Nin and Lois St. John, who was running it, and then I was sent up to Imphal, and with a canteen there, which was in an old building, and then we were evacuated at 24 hours notice because the Japs were threatening to break through between us and between Imphal and India and through Kohima. And so we were all evacuated and went back to Shillong for a bit.
Right.
And
what were you doing?
I was a secretarial work when I trained as a secretary when I left school.
Right, so you're doing that in Imphal
with the WASB? Well, no, I was just as a team, an ordinary
deputy,
right. Yes. Mm. No, the secretarial bit didn't come into my WASB life at
it
all,
didn't,
no.
Right. and then when you were, you regathered, regrouped in after 42, didn't it, was my understanding?
After the Imphal.
After the Imphal evacuation.
Yes, yes.
So then what were you doing, what happened then? Did you have some leave and...
I only once remember having leave, and that was when I was in ACAB. No, I think we were sent off in teams, and it was expanding. Teams were being sent to different, attached to different divisions and so on. And I think it was from there I went to Cox's Bazaar. I can't remember who we were with. That was a mobile canteen. They were all mobile canteens until we got to the war had actually finished. And then I went to ACAB, which was a huge island, which was virtually just an ordnance depot. I mean, there were stacks and stacks of shells just under canvas, And the Japs, of course, knew about it and were very keen on trying to do as much damage to, because that was where all the equipment was, all the military and the guns and things.
Right.
So we used to have bombardments every night, nearly every night. There was a squadron of Spitfires there, but they weren't night fighters, so we had to just sit. And the squadron leader was the Earl of Bandon, known as the Abandoned Earl, Paddy Bandon, and he went up one night in one of the Spitfires, absolutely illegally, because, you know, there were no runway lights or anything like that. He couldn't bear the thought of these chaps just cruising around and bombing the airstrips. Well, he talked his way out of it.
Right.
I mean, he came back all right. He came back all right, but it was a terribly dangerous thing, and there was nothing he could do very much.
Yeah.
I think it was just that people felt so frustrated seeing them flying over and dropping the bombs and not being any.
So what did you do?
We were in a house, an abandoned house, and they'd built an air raid. They dug an air raid shelter, and we just went down, just an underground shelter. And we just went down. And
pretty frightening.
Yes, it was.
Mm.
But.
And so, can you tell me about what you did on a very sort of day-to-day basis? You know, what you might have done in.
Akiab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you got up in the morning, what would be your first? I mean, who would cook? What would you have for breakfast, and who would cook it? And then, what were the first duties of the day?
I think we took it in turns to cook it. I can't remember what we actually ate for breakfast. I don't remember us being particularly short of food. But I do remember when we were in Imphal, we had dehydrated vegetables, and one of the elder Wasbys had sort of said she'd do the cooking and catering and so on, and putting in some dehydrated cabbage in a saucepan, and then it all absorbed the water and sort of flowed over the sides of the saucepan. And we were very short of, we didn't get any fresh food, and we did get sort of vitamin deficiency sores and things. And I think one of the things was that the army was the units were rationed so many ounces of meat per man, and you had so many hundred men, and that was so many cows. They never thought about us at that stage, because there were five or six of us, and we were far too small to sort of get any rations, and being Wasbys, we didn't complain. And then somebody sort of finally tumbled to it, and we got some ducks, and I said, well, rather than eat the ducks, let's keep them and have some eggs. And we used to have things like, we sold cornflakes and things, quite a lot of food things to the troops,
right.
And they would go off, and so they were written off on these inventories, and then they went to the ducks, who weren't so fussy, and they didn't lay for ages, but they started laying when the siege of Imphal, when we'd already been evacuated, when the siege of Imphal started, because Imphal was besieged for quite some months, and they laid eggs every day, so whoever was in our old quarters obviously enjoyed having them. Food, I think, was awful. It was spam,
mm-hmm.
and corned beef, and those awful sausages, I've forgotten what they were called. They're made with soya links. And very little in the way of vegetables. It would be perhaps, I don't know, we might have tinned peas or something like that.
Right.
So there wasn't anything very much in the way of interesting food.
Nothing local.
Well, that was one of the things. They weren't allowed or weren't supposed to buy locally, or only what was needed locally, because of sort of not affecting the civilian population. That if we sort of, you know, if the army bought up all the food, the local people would be in short supply. So a lot of it came up by, you know, transport.
Right. And how did you get your supplies in?
It came by the road. There was this marvellous mountain road, but it was a single track, So the ones coming up the mountain would start off at a certain time from down in Dimapur, and the ones going down would start off at a certain time from Imphal. And then halfway, there was a big area where everybody, and that was where we took the canteens to. So when the men arrived from having already done about 3 or 4 hours bumping up the road and down the road, and then there was a sort of general getting together and rest area, and we did hundreds of teas and cakes. Yes.
What, travelling up there every day?
Yes, we would travel down. We'd have to do the same thing. You see, we'd go down with the convoy and then come back with the lot going the other way.
Gosh.
Very often in the dark by then.
Were you driving?
We had we could all drive, but we had actual we were allocated drivers, mostly from the local British battalion of whatever was there. And I think the drivers, when they first were sort of allocated, they got terribly ribbed by their pals that were going to be driving for these. But they got very they were very helpful, and they would sort of keep an eye on things, and I think got quite attached to us. You know, they felt it was quite a worthwhile job in the end, shepherding the women and making sure that we didn't get things go wrong. Things always went wrong with the lorry or the jeep or whatever.
And so, when you set up canteen, what happened? How did that work?
Well, we would have been attached to a division, and the division would have decided where we were going to be, in a tent or a basha or whatever. And then we got our stores from the NAFI store place, and we would go and get. Depended what we sold. I mean, we sold things like cigarettes, of course, which went in enormous numbers. Shoe polish, writing paper, sweets. If we were just doing it in the lorry, if we had cooking facilities, then we cooked slab cakes and sold them by the slice, and then of course vast quantities of tea. And we would then get our found our quarters. We would then stock up the lorry, all the mobile canteens. The mobile canteens that were built for us were ridiculous, because they were obviously designed by somebody sitting in an air-conditioned office in Delhi, because they weren't even four-wheel drive, and they were very, very, very badly balanced.
Yeah.
And we were always getting stuck with the big back step came, big bit at the back came down as a step. And people stood on that, and we had a shelf across to serve over. But they weren't any good for that really bumpy country. And then we were just in lorries with everything in boxes and a list up, and you'd scrabble around and find what they wanted.
How did they know you were coming? And
was there a search
when you arrived?
Yes, and they were. That was up to the local commanders to sort of say the Wasbys will be with you and give us a list of we want you to go to the airfield on Monday and to go around the gun sites, who felt quite isolated and lonely. I mean, there'd perhaps just be half a dozen men and the gun, and constantly, of course, keeping a lookout. And they would be told when we were coming, and they would have notices like, Wasbys are coming on Monday, mind your language and put on your clean clothes, which was all part of the morale bit that I think was such an important bit of what we did.
Yeah.
So then we'd take it in turns, two people would go out, and when people came back and they were tired, then the other two would stock up for the next day. And then we would go and get our stores once a week or something like that.
Right. And when you arrived and made tea or cake, who did the cooking? Did you take your cook and bear?
Yes. As far as the big slab cakes and things were concerned, we had a cook who did it for us, who made the cakes in whatever kitchens. But Yes, I mean, we were greeted with great, I mean, it was very nice. We were greeted with great enthusiasm, and people would line up in an orderly fashion. And, and of course, we had to work out the change. We had to, and it never tallied with the inventory. You know, we used to, once a month, somebody used to come and we had to do a stock taking and then work it out what the money we should have had, and it never worked out right one way or another. In fact, Merle Landry said to us, we had a young man who came from the accounts department who came to show us how to do all this, and she said, "Yes, that's all right, but how do you cook the books?" Which wasn't a very sensible question to ask an accountant. But that was the least important bit of it, really. But we had to work out so many packets of cigarettes, so many packet of biscuits, and ink or writing paper or whatever. And we weren't entirely accurate at that, I'm afraid. But nobody complained. But that was the general feeling for them, I think, that we were willing to put up with it. It was hot. It was very humid. We were living in very primitive conditions, you know, hot water boiled up in a kerosene can and poor food and so on. We were young and we were enthusiastic and we didn't mind, but I think that was a large part of the job, was the morale raising. If we were prepared to go out and do these things, they didn't feel quite so forgotten.
That's an appropriate word for the walk. I understand as well that you were expected to sometimes to go to a lot of dances or go be socially involved with troops. Do you have memories of that?
Oh yes, and when I became a sergeant, and that was up in Imphal, we got invited to, we got invited to the sergeant, one other WASB sergeant, invited to the local sergeant's mess, the engineers, and of course they would have been able to sort of get things on, you know, the odd chicken or something that, you know, embarrassing. So it was worthwhile being invited to the sergeant's mess, because you had better food there than you had anywhere else. And again, I suppose there would be about 10 or a dozen sergeants, and they'd invite. And on one occasion, we were invited to one of the medical units, Ford medical units, and there was, I think, two or three young officers, medical thing. And they had been impressed on the cook that this was a very special occasion. They were entertaining us and what we were going to have, and they were going to start with soup and so on, and, you know, make everything look as nice as possible. And then we were faced with the bearer coming round with a jerry. It had been set up for this. This is a beautiful thing when we had this, put the soup in. You know, it was supposed to be rather special, but you can imagine the four young officers were absolutely horrified. So, and we had an official roster of days off, you know, so that have some time to relax. And we wanted to make things look as sort of homey as possible. We had sort of, you know, gingham cloths and tea cloths and tablecloths, and curtains and things, which we sort of, if we just had a tent or something, we'd hang them up and sort of try and make it look a little bit. Yeah. And there were always people popping in for some reason or other. When we were in Japan, something went wrong. We had the electrical engineer, the engineers opposite, and they said that with the alarms or the electricity, and they came in and they kept on coming back every day to see if it was still working all right, you know. quite understandable then, and they couldn't, I guess so they'd stay for a cup of tea while they were there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brilliant. And so, did you ever feel in danger? You talked about the air raids, but you had money, you had stocks, you were young women out.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things actually that was. Outstanding, really, that there we were, just five or six women, and we never, until after the end of the official end of the war, I think there was only one situation where somebody had sort of had a bit of a sort of had to push somebody off. Otherwise, we were completely. I think we were looked on as being their WASPs, it must have been very tempting to see these, but we never had any trouble that way. We didn't expect it. We didn't.
Yeah.
We weren't frightened of it. We didn't expect it, and we never got it.
Mm-hmm.
And the parties we always went to, and there's always sort of two or three of us went,
It was. But quite a few WASPs were married, too.
Yes, the first lot particularly, who had been. Sort of planters' wives or officers' wives from the headquarters.
Mm. There were quite a few women who met their husbands when they were
in
the service.
Yes, yes.
I've seen pictures of
weddings
and celebrations.
We had a couple of WASPI weddings in Rangoon, I think.
What else? I was interested. Could you tell me about my grandmother?
Well, she was.
How you knew her?
She was there when I first arrived in Shillong, and I think my first impression was that what a strong woman she was, strong character, and that one would feel that whatever she organised would work. And I think she didn't take no for an answer. If she thought that one thing she was pushing as much as possible that we should go as far forward as possible, which was what we all wanted. But of course, a lot of the divisional generals and so on, in the first place, were not awfully happy about us having us there, and they were worried about the responsibility and would we get hurt and so on. But we were official army units, so that and that was what your grandmother always stressed with them. They are army; they can be moved around. And go where they're told, and they won't be any trouble, and they won't complain about things. And that was what she always used to put across to us. And she was incredible energy, and she would go off and she would sort of see what was happening and think, well, that would be good if we had a WASB canteen there. And then and they'd say no, and. But they always ended up by saying yes, all right.
No,
yes, and I think we felt a great loyalty to her, to come up to what she was telling the commanders. They will do what they're told. They won't be in the way. They won't be make a fuss about things. That worked very well, and people felt.
Mm.
It had been an okay kind of arrangement, and became very, so was very much as part of their outfit, and saw the value of it. But she had great vision. She had great ability to sort of foresee what was happening and what was going on, and she'd be there, She'd manage to she'd turn up at headquarters somewhere or other, and they'd say, how did you get here? This is the forward zone. And she'd say, I got a lift on the left plane that was coming in, and all sorts of things.
Do you remember the time that she did that? Was it?
I can't remember the place, but there was certainly an occasion. I think it was when they were sort of halfway down Burma, and on the Chindwin bit, where it was quite dicey, and there were pockets of Japs around, although they were in retreat.
Mm.
There were quite large pockets of Japs around, And she flew into headquarters there and sort of and I said, what are you doing here? How did you get here? You know, there shouldn't be women in this bit. And she said, oh, well, you know. And that as soon as things were a little bit better, she'd want to. She'd hope they'd place a WASP canteen there. I think they all just gave in. It was difficult to argue with her because she knew what she wanted and she just put it so clearly. Mm. And as we got a reputation for being of value as far as morale and as far as providing stores, because I mean, I think it was important for them to sort of feel they could buy their own cigarettes. I mean, they could have had them issued from the stores, but you know, they could come and buy exactly what they wanted, mm-hmm. and have somebody selling it to them and somebody chatting to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I remember one night we were, and the last lot of chaps that came to the canteen to buy things, they were looking rather anxious, and they had grenades hanging from their belts, and they were going out on night patrol that night. And you know, it was very important to them, mm. to see us and talk to us. And when the Wingate lot went in, we were on the airstrip selling just tea and cake or tea. And then when the first aeroplane took off, all our rupee notes were fluttering around. Everybody, for ages, people were sort of picking the rupee notes out of the bushes. But no, she was the one who held it together, and I think she was very, a very good match. She and Lois St. John, who was the second in command, who was a very sort of motherly. You know, she was very good on organising the sort of practical things. She stayed at Shillong, and you know, she welcomed people and saw them off, and was a shoulder to cry on, you know, and was always there. So the two of them made a marvellous, for our point of view, a marvellous combination, really.
Right. Mm. Did you know them? Did you?
Not a great deal, because she was on the go a lot. She was away a lot, and she would come round. And once you were out in, I mean, basically, her headquarters was at Shillong. And when we were out in the canteens, scattered all over the place, she would come round and see us fairly regularly. But she'd just stay overnight or just call in and. You want to know what the problems were or what difficulties and what we needed, anything we needed in the way of stores. Somehow she managed to twist somebody's arm to get it. So I didn't know her all that well, but, you know, when she came round and visited. And then when she began, you know, she wanted to expand still further. She was recruited from Australia, I think. There was an Australian Mosby who went out to recruit Mercy. What was her name? Not Anne Mercy. But she had this ability to really see the way things were going and how to get in right at the beginning. And then I think she knew exactly what sort of limitations and problems there would be, and would tell us. But she always knew how to organise things so that people were covered, were looked after, so that they weren't left. Mm. If there was any crisis, so they knew what was happening. I mean, when we were out of Imphal, motorcycle messengers came round. I think we had two canteens there. to the two canteens and just said, you must go back. And we went back, and somebody there just to say to us, you know, you've got an hour to pack and when we must go, sort of thing. Stores and things. But she would be in touch with all that and make sure that we were properly cared for when we got to the other end.
Did she ever talk about mother, my mother?
No, because how old would she be, then? I mean, she had photos of her, but I don't remember hearing about her as...
No, nine. She was born in 33. Mm-hmm.